In the beginning, there was Visual Basic. I've skipped over some details, the formation of the Earth, the dinosaurs, the Hundred Years' War, that kind of stuff. But as far as modern Windows programming is concerned, in the beginning, there was Visual Basic. VB was a great innovative system. It allowed a very component-oriented approach to programming Windows. People could ship control libraries, they could ship extensions. There were well-defined interfaces for calling those things, the VBX interface. It was kind of limited. It was shockingly limited, but it worked. Unfortunately, it's very bound to 16-bit Windows, and when 32-bit Windows came along, it would had to be replaced, or the underlying component infrastructure of Visual Basic had to be replaced. And what it was replaced with was something that had been already prepared for object linking and embedding in Office, a technology called the Component Object Model, or COM. And I would like to read you an encomium to COM that was written at the time. I love COM. COM is good. Like a fine pilsner or ale, COM never disappoints. In fact, the more I look at COM, the more I like it. I won't embarrass the author of that quote by naming him, but there are some clues on that page. The trouble with, and COM was a very successful platform. I mean, it still underpins an awful lot of what we do. It underpinned things like Explorer Shell Extensibility, it underpins a lot of what Office does, it underpinned the component technologies of the late 90s. And with the constrained execution environments we had at the time, COM was a really good technology. But COM had some limitations. In particular, metadata was a big problem for COM. For example, when the Microsoft Transaction Server people shipped their product, they wanted people to be able to annotate their COM components with attributes declaring, I require a transaction, or I never want to be in a transaction, or I can use a transaction, it's already one in progress, that kind of thing. But COM didn't have the extensibility of metadata. And in particular, it had no way to advertise custom metadata. It had two metadata forms, IDL, which was kind of C++ oriented, and TLB, which was a binary format and was buggy. So that was a good start. And it meant that, for example, when Visual Basic programmers wanted to write components for MTS or for COM Plus as it sort of evolved into, the platform developers had to wait for the Visual Basic IDE to catch up. They had to wait for the Visual Basic team to build in custom support for that metadata so that VB developers could annotate their components to work with these new technologies. So everything got a bit kind of brittle and tightly coupled, and teams had a lot of dependencies. Another problem was that COM didn't really have a lot of helper methods. It didn't really have a standard library that you could call on to do stuff, because you'd call the Win32 API. Everyone does that, right? VB developers loved that. Win32 was great if you were a C developer. Otherwise, it was kind of a bit difficult. It was kind of hard work to do from Visual Basic. So in the late 90s, early 2000s, Microsoft were thinking of, we want to provide a new programming environment that provides this additional metadata support. It provides a rich standard library and supports different languages, C++, Visual Basic, and any new languages that might not compete with Java that might come along. And what they came up with, they brilliantly thought they would call COM3. Unfortunately, some bright spark then discovered, oh wait, COM3 is an illegal directory name on most versions of Windows, so we better not call it that after all. It was also very known as Lightning, which is a tribute to its origins in Visual Basic, which was originally known as Thunder. It was occasionally known as the Universal Runtime, but it eventually got taken over by the marketing people and given an ungoogleable name, sorry, an unbingable name, .NET. .NET was an attempt to solve all of these problems, or solve at least many of these problems. It introduced extensible metadata via the attribute system. It provided clear method and type level metadata just via the DLL format, via the metadata tables. It supported garbage collection out of the box, which COM kind of made difficult. So it provided a lot of these features that COM was struggling with. Microsoft also shipped the CLR, the Common Language Runtime, which was the underlying foundation of .NET, but they also wrote a specification called the Common Language Infrastructure, which they submitted to a standardization organization. So there are actually two things that we can talk about when we talk about .NET. We can talk about the CLI, the standard, or the CLR, the implementation by Microsoft. And this is important because having a standard meant that other people could go out and implement their own versions of that standard. In particular, the Mono guys, Miguel de Acarta and his merry crew, thought it would be great to have this on Linux. You know, we could do with a handy component infrastructure on Linux. Let's nick Microsoft's. Let's implement their standard. And Mono has prospered to this day. It is now the foundation of the Xamarin cross-platform effort and powers a lot of what they do on, for example, iOS and Android. So .NET is now reaching beyond that Windows platform it was originally designed for. The C# and Visual Basic languages have consequently become fairly thin layers over the underlying CLR. Now, over time, they've become richer and richer. For example, with the introduction of link, with the introduction of async await, they're beginning to add a lot of additional stuff over the baseline CLR. But really, they're quite, at the foundational level, they're quite thin wrappers. And therefore, it's important for developers working with C# or Visual Basic or any of the .NET languages to really understand the foundation, to understand the platform that we are running on. It also turns out that a lot of issues or questions, a lot of problems that we have are not really language-level problems. They're problems that they are trying to understand what's going on at the foundational level. Asking questions in the context of C# or Visual Basic is not always the right thing to do. Asking about what's happening at the CLR level is often a more appropriate question. And often, for example, framework design guidelines about how you should design your APIs are intended to work across languages, precisely so that you've got this language interop story going on. So what I want to talk about today are, there's three core dimensions, I think, to what the CLR does. There's the virtual execution system, which services like loading DLLs, memory management, that kind of thing. There's the common type system, which enables interop between languages, enables consumption of binary components. And there's the standard core libraries. What I'm going to focus on today is the virtual execution system and the underlying sort of metadata common type system aspects that go with that. And that means I'm going to kind of fall into two main parts here. Firstly, looking at how the CLR represents programs, that is static aspects of the CLR, and how the CLR executes programs, the dynamic aspects of the CLR. And I don't have a particularly kind of strong agenda here of a story I want to tell or things I want to talk about. So if you've got questions or want to take the talk in a particular direction, do put your hand up or shout at me or something and let me know if there's something you want to dive into a little bit further. So beginning with the static aspects of the CLR. The fundamental concepts here are types and members. Every piece of data in the CLR has a type. It is not like C, where you have a bag of bits and you can say, today I shall interpret this as an integer, or today I shall interpret this as a pointer and crash my program. Each piece of data has a type. You cannot use it in a way other than what the type permits. The runtime ensures that types are represented correctly. And the CLR defines a number of types as sort of primitive baked-in types to which it gives special treatment, has special understanding. And these are the numeric types, so byte, 16-bit integer, which we call short in C#, 32-bit integer, 64-bit integer, 4-byte floating point, single precision floating point, double precision floating point, string, and object. And you may think, well, there's also other things in C#. For example, the decimal type, which is a primitive in C#. That is not a primitive in the CLR. That is something that is built up from these other more primitive components with operations defined on it. And C# just puts some syntactic sugar around it to make it look like it's a base type. But at the CLR level, it's not. Similarly, some languages give you syntactic sugar for big integer for arbitrarily large integers. But again, that's actually defined in another assembly. Types fall into two categories, reference types and value types. And the CLR unifies these two aspects of the type system. There is a unified type system, which means that everything is convertible to the base type of system.object. Now, people sometimes think that everything inherits from system.object. That's not the case. For example, interface types don't inherit from system.object, but they are convertible to object. Managed references and managed pointers do not inherit from object, but are convertible to it. So we'll dive into some demos and we'll have a look. So here I've got a type in which I have a method which uses ref and out parameters. I've also defined another method with an unsafe context which uses a managed pointer, which is a pretty obscure thing that you might use an interop sometimes, but otherwise generally stay away from. And if I have a look at, if I get this thing to print out the those methods, so I'm going to go over the methods of that type, print out their parameters, and we'll see what those parameter types are. And you can see those funny symbols int32 ampersand for those ref and out parameters and int32 star for those object parameters. And what I can do now is I can say, what are the base types of those? And I can run that up. And I get a null reference exception. Why do I get that? Because that parameter type is int32 reference, and it doesn't have a base type. So when people tell you that all types in the CLR derive from object, it's not true. They are all convertible to object. That's a slightly, subtly different thing. But for the most part, we don't deal with managed references or with managed pointer types. We only deal with reference types and value types. Reference types are the classes that we're all familiar with, and they have identity. So you can have an object of reference type, it's somewhere out on the heap, and you can have multiple references within your program all pointing to the same thing. It has identity. Value types do not have identity. They only have value. When you pass a value around, the bits get copied rather than a reference to that thing out there being copied. The actual thing itself gets copied. And therefore, you get effectively a new instance of the value type. This can result in a certain amount of confusion because as you pass things around, particularly if you've got mutable value types. Value types are handy. Well, let me show you something. Let me bring that back. Okay. One of the One of the aspects of, pardon me, I've got my demos in the wrong order, so do forgive me. There we go. So in C sharp, we introduce a value type with the struct keyword, and here is a nice, well-behaved value type. And notice here, I can new up two instances of that value type, and I'm going to test whether those are equal. Now, if that was a reference type, then that would produce me two different instances. They would contain the same data, but they would not be equal. In the case of a value type, we want them to be equal because they have the same value. So. So we'll just walk through there, and you can see that those are indeed equal, even though they're different instances. Now, one thing that we find is that the CLR has implemented value type equality for us. How has it implemented it? Well, I have good news and I have bad news. If I look at this value type dot equals, it's got this rather magical clause in it that says, if we can compare the bits of these two value types, then use a fast equality check. Otherwise, use reflection. Now, what is this can compare bits thing? Well, we can compare the bits, the CLR says, if all of the components of the value type, all of the fields of the value type, are simple primitive types and they are tightly packed. What does tightly packed mean? Well, that's to do with object layout in memory. And for example, those two integers can be tightly packed together. But if I declare y to be a long instead, previously those equality comparisons took 57 milliseconds. By screwing up the alignment, by preventing it from being tightly packed, suddenly I've blown up the equality testing by a factor of 10. So value type equality testing, or the built-in value type equality testing, is very brittle in terms of performance. You could make a small, seemingly innocent change to a value type, and suddenly the performance characteristics change dramatically. So if you're going to implement a custom value type like point, strongly recommend that you override equals and get hash code. Or rather, I recommend you override equals, and if you're going to override equals, you have to override get hash code, or the compiler will complain. And if I run that now, you can see, well, actually, that's now even faster than it was with the can compare bits check. So always override dot equals. Another idiom that I've shown here is that my value type here is immutable. Its fields are all read-only. The reason for this is that modifying a value type kind of doesn't really make sense. They are values. If you want to change it, you get a different value. For example, if my account balance is a money value of $1,000, I want to change my account balance to $2,000. Well, I don't want to do that by changing what $1,000 means. I mean, it'd be handy for some people, but it might mess up our banking system quite a bit. I need to create a new value, a $2,000 value, and set account.balance equals $2,000, not $1,000.amount equals $2,000, because that would be quite bad. It also leads to horrific confusion, because value types get copied. When you make changes to them, you may or may not be working on the original one. For example, here is an evil point type, which is mutable. I can set its properties. And there I go, there I am setting its property. And that will work fine. I'm pretty confident that will be good. But what happens when I do that? What happens when I have an array? I put the point into an array and then modify it through there. What happens when I make a local variable of that member in the array and modify that? Let's try and find out. So that first one modified the local variable point, but it didn't modify the copy in the array. Then that one modified the copy in the array, didn't modify the local one. And then that one didn't modify either of them because it was yet another copy of that point. This would get even more confusing if you had something like this. We had a property of a mutable value type, but thankfully the compiler at that point steps in and says, no, this is just madness. It's not, you can't do this. And at this point, the compiler knows that the return value of .origin is not a variable. It's a copy of something, and it's not actually sort of a nameable, addressable thing. So modifying its value, it really is just a complete waste of time. I guess you could argue there could be some logic in the setter, but that would be really, really naughty. So don't do that. Now, I said that all types are convertible to object, and in fact, value types inherit from object. But object is a reference type. So what happens when you put a value type into an object? It's actually even worse than that, because value types derive from a class called system.valueType. And what do we reckon? Value type is not a value type because reasons. That's why. So in a sense, when you define a value type, you're kind of getting two values, two types for the price of one. You're getting this kind of inline thing that is just the bits, the actual struct, as you might think of it. And then you've got a thing called a boxed representation. So when you put a value type into an object variable, it gets boxed. And the box is just a reference that contains the bits of the value and a note as to kind of what type it was. But boxing also becomes a source of confusion, again, because we're copying things rather than just using them. It doesn't help that C# has chosen a notation for boxing and unboxing that looks like something else altogether. So when I write a cast in C# like that, that's actually a cast because I've got two reference types in play. When I write that cast from int to long, that is not a cast. That is not mapped to the same thing at the CLR level as my cast did. It maps to a conversion operation between those two built-in types. So the CLR itself has knowledge of that conversion, and the C# compiler does some sneaky stuff to translate it. What if I cast an object to a long? Well, C# sees I'm converting a reference type to a value type and goes, well, that's actually not a cast. That's an unbox operation. And finally, when I cast, for example, a decimal to an integer, remember we said decimal was not a built-in type, the CLR has got no knowledge of it, that can't be a cast because it's between two value types. But what it does do is it invokes a user-defined conversion operator. So if I... jump in here, then we can look at, you can see that that reference conversion, that reference cast, results in a cast class instruction at the IL level, whereas that object value results in an unbox instruction. Now, why is this important? It's important because the value in the box has a particular type, and when you are casting it, you're actually unboxing it back into its value form. You are not converting it. So, if I were to pass an integer into there, one, two, three. What's going to happen? It's going to not compile because one of these devil things has locked the output. Yes, thank you for that. Right. When in doubt, reload everything. When in doubt, reload everything. Right, thank you. No. All right. You're going to build now? Kill everything. That sounds like a good plan. There we go. I had something still running, didn't I? That was... There we go. So although an int which I passed in is convertible to a long, that doesn't work. What I need to do instead, if I want this to work, is to write this very ugly expression like that, and now life is good. So what's happening there is there's actually two conversion operations. There's an unbox to get the int out of the object box, followed by a conversion to long, and it can't do that in one step. The C# compiler cannot generate appropriate code for that because at the CLR level, different things are happening. All right, boxing plays particularly entertainingly with mutable value types. So remember how I told you never to make mutable value types? All right, it's going to get worse. So here, I'm going to create myself a mutable point. I'm going to box it into an object, and then I'm going to make a dynamic out of it so I can take its .x value without having to muck around with reflection. Now, if I set the x-coordinate on the local variable, that's going to obviously update the struct. What if I set that through the boxed copy, through the object? What if I unbox it and set the value? What if I set the value via reflection on the local variable? What if I set it on the dynamic? What if I set it on the object? Can anyone predict what that's going to do? It's going to do awful things. That's not what I want. So let's look at the code again. Let's see what happened there. Well, local variable did get set to 2. Boxed copy got set to 3, didn't affect the local. Unbox, modify, didn't affect anything. Reflection modify of the local didn't affect it, even though I gave it the local there. Well, why not? Because if I look at set value takes an object. What happens when I put the local into an object? Boxed copy. So the reflection did set a value, but it set it on a boxed copy, which I'm not paying any attention to. So that was no use to anybody. What about when I do it on the dynamic? Well, that's weird. Again, nothing happened. Even though that dynamic is pointing at the object, the boxed copy wasn't affected. I have to admit, I'm not quite sure why it works that way. I have a feeling that what's happening is it's finding a slightly different method from what I was expecting. It's using the value type method, and therefore something strange is going on, possibly with unboxing to modify it. But anyway, it doesn't actually touch that boxed copy. Whereas if I do it via the boxed copy, then actually, yeah, that does take effect. So, mutable value types. This is me down on my knees. I am begging you, never, ever create a mutable value type. Only pain and suffering can follow. All right. Just as a heads up, by the way, if you declare an interface, that also causes box. If you refer to a value type via an interface, you're also going to get boxing going on, so that can also be quite confusing. Okay. One of the things that we use a lot in .NET is interfaces. And we sometimes run into a problem where we want to implement multiple interfaces, for example, on the same type, but those interfaces have intersecting members. And in order to support that, we can use the C# technique of explicit interface implementation. VB actually has a different way of doing it, which is actually sort of a little bit cleaner and clearer in some ways. But what's actually going on under the surface of that interface implementation? So if I have a look there, then here are two interfaces, both of which have a where method. And here is a class that implements both of those interfaces. And you can see I've created a public where method, but I've also explicitly implemented the ipantaloon.where and the iabradable.where. Now, what happens at the IL level? What's going on at the IL level that to represent that? Let's have a look. So we've got a public where method, which is what you'd expect because that's what we declared. We've also got this ipantaloon.where method. And notice that that is marked as private, and it's also marked as virtual, which is a combination that you don't usually see. So it is not part of the public interface of this type, which kind of makes sense, because if a method is explicitly implemented, then if you have a reference to the object type, the concrete type, you can't call the interface method directly. You have to get an interface reference to it and call through that. So yeah, it makes sense it's not part of the public interface. By contrast, if I have something that implements an interface implicitly, then you can see that is public virtual, even though I've not put the virtual marker on it. Methods that implement interfaces are always virtual at the CLR level, even if you don't mark them as such. And the reason for that is that something further down the chain could re-implement the interface, and you want that re-implementation to override it. I'll talk a little bit more later about how that stuff actually gets represented at runtime, because again, we've got this problem of we've got several things in the method table for the type, which we want to be able to address as where in different contexts. So how does that actually get represented? And I'll show you that a little bit later on. First of all, I want to talk about some special members that are important to understand. The object-based type defines two methods, equals and get hash code, which are important for representing identity of objects. We've talked about how value types, you get an automatic value-oriented value semantics implementation of equals. For reference types, by default, it's instance equality, it's reference equality. But sometimes you want to have a reference type which has got different equality semantics, more value-like equality semantics. A classic example of that is string. String is a reference type, but we want to be able to treat it as if it were a value. The reason it's a reference type is because, firstly, a big string would be a pain to pass around. Remember, value types, we copy all of the bits. If you've got a 100 megabyte string, we don't want to copy all of the bits. The other reason it's got to be reference type is that value types are essentially fixed in size. They've got memory allocated for them based on their set of fields. A string needs to be able to vary in size. So string is a reference type, but it needs to override equality. And you can do that for your own types as well, but there are pitfalls. Here, for example, is a name type. So I want to have a type representing name because I want to be able to guarantee that, firstly, I want to be able to distinguish names from random other strings. I don't want somebody passing a message in where I'm expecting a name. I also want to be able to ensure that, for example, equality is always done using done case insensitively. My names are to be case insensitive. Well, that's fine. I define a class, it has a member, and I override equals. In my equals method, I check, am I being compared to another name? If I am, then I'll use a string comparer. If I'm not, then obviously it can't be the same. Does that look sensible? Does that make sense to people? Yep. Small problem. What if I later come up with the idea of a name that sits inside a namespace? Well, that's not a problem. I can just override dot equals on that, and life remains good. And then I can do operations like that, and it will correctly tell me that the Microsoft server does not equal my server. But what if I do that? Well, now, when I go and look at the Skynet server, check its equals, is the other object a name? Yes, it is. It's a scoped name, but it's still a name. Therefore, I will do a comparison on the text. And that means that the Microsoft server is equal to the Skynet server, which you may find reassuring or not, I don't know. Clearly, that's not what you want. So if you're going to override equals, you need to be very careful about either sealing your types so they can't be inherited from, or making sure that your comparisons, that your equality checks, allow for the possibility of derived types being passed in. Other rules around equality, which are, again, unfortunately, are not enforced by the compiler, but which are essential for things to behave correctly, are equality's got to be reflexive, symmetric, and transitive. So an object must be equal to itself. If A equals B, then B must equal A. And if A equals B and B equals C, then A must equal C. Sometimes I am tempted to write approximate value type classes where I think, I'll just put sort of, it can be a range of values like that. And you can override equality and just say, you know, if they're close enough, then, you know, two doubles, they're only out by the last decimal place, call them equal, nobody will know. Doesn't work so well. So, for example, if I take these three values, then, yeah, A equals B, B equals C, but A doesn't equal C. Same, A equals B, B doesn't equal A. And a lot of assumptions that both the jitter, both the CLR, and your readers of your code make about how things work will fall apart. So be careful with those laws. The compiler will not catch you, will not save you if you get things wrong. The evil twin of equals is get hash code. And the main rule for get hash code is that equal objects must have an equal hash code. Hash code is used for a variety of things. The most obvious one is when the object uses a key into a dictionary. It's used for other things as well, but that's the most obvious one. The subtle rule of get hash code is that it must remain the same for the entire lifetime of the object. Because if it's being used as a key for something and the hash code changes, then the dictionary implementation will no longer be able to find that thing. Dictionary groups objects, it's going to look for objects, it's going to look for matching hash codes, matching equality. And if you change the hash code, then things go wrong. So in this example, I'm going to keep a directory of all the evil people I know about and where they live, because that seems like a handy thing to have. And if I change the name, I would kind of expect that I would not lose track of the evil person just because I changed their name. They are still the key of that dictionary. But if I've overwritten get hash code to make use of the name, then that's not going to work. Even though Bob is in that dictionary, the dictionary implementation can no longer find him because his hash code has changed. So we've got rules that are pretty similar to what we talked about for value types. If you're going to be overriding get hash code, make sure that you are only dealing with immutable fields. By all means, if you've got other mutable data in there, then that's okay, but don't use it in your hash code. All right. Any questions on that so far? Yes. Is there a rule that if two objects equal each other, they must have the same hash code? Yes, that's correct. So again, this is something the compiler will not catch for you. If you override dot equals, then you must override get hash code so that the rule applies that if two objects are equal, they must have the same hash code. Now, in my evil example, I did that. So if I've got two equal objects, they will have the same ID and the same name, which means they will indeed have the same hash code. But because the hash code changes over the lifetime, it's still a problem. If I'd left dot equals unchanged, that was still reference identity, then I would have a bigger problem. Well, first of all, C# would not let me compile it, which would be quite a big problem. But also, I would now be able to have, I wouldn't have a big problem. I'd just have a compilation failure. C# doesn't let you do that. It is possible to write code where two equal objects end up with different hash codes because your implementations got out of sync, again, that will cause a mess for dictionaries because it will go, great, I found something with that hash code. Oh, it's not equal. Hmm. So again, this is all part of the rules around equality and hash codes. All right. Pardon, could you say again? How do I declare value types? So how do I specify that a type is going to be a value type? Yes. Okay, the question is what does a value type usually look like? How do I make it immutable? One answer is I use C# 6 primary constructors and life is easy. But for those of us who are stuck on a shipping version of C#, we have to write some boring code. So here is my example of a point structure, a value type. I declare all of the fields to be read-only. I can't stop people from actually sort of using reflection to go and do naughty things, but I can make sure that at the language level and at the CLR level, it's declared as immutable. Then I provide a constructor by which people can initialize those fields. So they can say, I want to point at 1, 2, or 17, 14, or whatever. And this is kind of optional, but it's pretty common with plain old data types, I declare get-only properties to surface those fields. And as I say, I would also recommend overriding equals and get hash code, but that's for performance reasons. The CLR will actually give you an implementation of those if you don't do it. Does that answer your question? Okay, sweet. All right, so moving on to dynamic aspects of the CLR. Running very low on time, I'm afraid. The CLR is a stack machine. So it is a very simple machine at runtime. It does not have registers, it does not have variables. Everything sits on a stack. So if you've got a reference object, a reference type, the actual type itself sits out on the heap, but the references to that thing sit on the stack. So all your local variables always sit on a stack. This makes the implementation of the CLR very simple. For some values, very simple. The actual operating instructions of the CLR are something called Common Intermediate Language or Microsoft Intermediate Language, depending on whether you're talking about the standard or the implementation. And these are abstract instructions for working on that stack-based virtual machine. Those are not low-level machine instructions like moves and EAXs and things like that. These are at a higher level. And when your program runs, there is a component called the JITTER, the just-in-time compiler, that turns those instructions into machine code as it encounters them, or as a method, as it encounters each method. And I'll show you how objects are laid out. This is a rather intimidating diagram, but it's actually reasonably easy to understand. If I've got an object reference on the stack or somewhere, that is actually one of these object instance types. And that is just a reference to something that's out there on the heap. And the thing that is on the heap, the actual object itself, contains something called a sync block index, which gets used when you use a lock statement on the object, a type handle, which is essentially the pointer to the object's type, and the instance fields. For a value type, we don't have all of this stuff. We don't have all of this overhead, because a value type, you just have the bits there. And that makes a pretty dramatic difference to, for example, the sizes of these things. So if we look back on our point, I allocate, I think, about 10 million of them. Then how much space does that take? That takes 160. That's actually because I change that back to being longs. So if I change that back to being integers, then we can see it's actually going to be just 8 bytes per instance. There we go. If I change that to a class and allocate the same number of them, look at the impact on memory. The overhead of the sync block index and the type handle more than doubles the size of that. In fact, you've got the object instance, which is 4 bytes, and then you've got the sync block, which is 4 bytes, and the type handle, which is 4 bytes. It gets worse. Let me run using the 64-bit CLR. Now I have an 8-bit object reference, an 8-bit sync block index, and an 8-byte type handle. So I've added 24 bytes per instance of overhead over and above the actual fields. So that's a factor in deciding between structs and classes. Small things often work well as structs if they have value semantics, because they avoid all of that overhead. When the type is spun up, you've got these method slots, which you can see around here, which are the methods that are defined by the type. And each of those has a pointer to the method descriptor. And initially, each of those points to a sort of little stub, which doesn't do anything, but says, hey, I've not been compiled yet. When the jitter runs on a method, what it does is it compiles the IL to machine code, and then it overwrites the address in that method table with the address of the compiled machine code. So it doesn't need to check each time, have I compiled this? The fact that it's indirecting via this pointer means it either goes to the hey compile me stub routine, or it just goes straight to the implementation. So the overhead, once the method has been jitted, is very, very low. The jitter can also be quite smart about optimizing things. For example, it can elide things from the stack if they're not actually any use to anybody. For example, here I have a method. I'm going to call into another method. That's just going to do a console.write line of C. And C is going to throw an exception, so I can look at the stack trace. So if I run that up, you'll see A has called into B, B has called into the getter of C, which is what you'd expect. Now if I run that outside the debugger, look what's missing. A has called directly into C. It appears that A has called directly into C. But that's impossible because we've gone through B. We must have gone through B. Well, actually, the jitter can elide some of that stuff because it goes, well, actually, well, I'll just compile things in line. I will inline stuff. I don't need to create a whole additional stack frame for B, because B is such a feeble, useless method. I'll just fold it into the body of A. Life is good. If you were to look at that at the IL level, you will still see B being there. It is the jitter, the just-in-time compiler, that has got rid of that. And the jitter can also do some clever things around recursion, for example. Suppose that Suppose I wish to determine whether a large number is even or odd. How would you do that? Check the last bit. You have no imagination, sir. thank you, Bevan. As a real functional programmer, I would write a pair of mutually recursive functions. If you laugh, I'll do this in F sharp, I'm warning you. Write a pair of mutually recursive functions. Okay, maybe that's not a realistic example, but it's still an instructive one. So if I fire that up, well, that's kind of the problem with using mutual recursion. I get a long way down that stack, but eventually I just run out because I've got so many calls from one function to another to another to another to another. What if I change to the 64-bit CLR? No stack overflow. Why is that? Now you may think that's because 64 bits, we can have huge stack. That's not actually the case, as you will see if I run that under the debugger, and I will. This will probably bring down Visual Studio again, but what the heck. Even though it's 64-bit, the process is terminated due to stack overflow exception. So what is happening in the 64-bit case where it is not running under the debugger? Well, the 64-bit jitter is smart about something called tail recursion. Tail recursion happens when the recursive call is to, or sorry, when the value of the function is the value of the recursive call. So in these cases, the value of is odd is the value of is even. There's nothing further to do with the return value of is even. I don't need to come back to is odd in order to make any in order to do any more work with it. So effectively, I can just do a go to. I can just hand off control and never come back to is odd. And then is even can hand off control to is odd and never come back to is even. And they can keep bouncing back and forth rather than going down, 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 just ping pong back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the 64-bit jitter is smart enough to recognize this pattern and convert it into a effectively into a go-to to get rid of that stack frame. And the takeaway from this is we often think about stack frames when we're debugging, looking at stack traces in the debug windows. We think about them as telling us this is how I got here. This is the chain of methods that I went through to get here. They are not. The stack trace tells you how to get back to where you started, which is a very different thing. In many cases, it's the same. But where you've got something like tail recursion involved, it can be very, very different. So remember that. And that's, you know, similarly with the inlining, things can just go away. All right. I want to talk just for, I've only got a couple of minutes left. I want to talk very briefly about garbage collection. One of the great benefits of the CLR over the unmanaged environment is that it takes care of memory for you. You can just allocate and allocate and allocate and allocate and allocate, and life is good. You just keep getting more memory. You don't need to worry about doing a free or using something after it's been released or whatever, the way you had to in the C environment. And the way it does this is pretty clever, and it's kind of interesting because it also shows how GC can perform better than manual memory management for many cases. The way that the .NET Garbage Collector works in a simplified manner is it pre-allocates a big chunk of memory, and it sets a pointer at one end of that memory saying, this is where I'm going to put the next object. And when you allocate a new object, when you new up an object, it just moves the pointer along. Allocate another one, moves the pointer along some more. Allocate another, moves along some more. Allocation is really, really fast. There's no mucking around looking over the free store and worrying about heap fragmentation and coalescing block lists and all those joyous things that C-memory managers do. You move a pointer. It's job done. It's fantastic. There is one tiny problem, which is that at some point you get to the end of the list. You run out of blocks and it tries to move the pointer on and it goes, oh, page fault. Not so nice. Can't access that memory. And that is when garbage collection kicks in. It only kicks in when it actually runs out of memory. When garbage collection kicks in, the garbage collector basically goes through looking at all the objects on there. Or sorry, it doesn't look good. It goes through a set of routes. So it looks at static variables, it looks at objects on or members on the stack, and looks at members in registers. And it marks all of those as these are in use. And then if those have any more object pointers within them, it follows those and marks those things as being in use as well. When it's finished tracing and it's tracked all of the things, it goes, right, everything that's in use, I'm going to shove it down there. Push. Everything gets collapsed down to one end of the line and everything else is garbage. The pointer is reset to there and next allocation, boink, boink, boink. Easy, fast, quick. Now, you may rightly worry that if we've got a big-ass heap of memory and we've filled it all up with stuff and we come to do a garbage collection, then actually that's going to take quite a long time to scan. So what the .NET garbage collector does is it splits that heap into what it calls generations. You have a generation zero heap, which is quite small, a generation one heap, which is bigger, and a generation two heap, which is bigger still. In fact, you can have multiple generation two heaps. And it does all of its allocation in the generation zero heap, generation zero segment. That's quite small, so when that runs out, it's really quick to collect. What it does is it then moves anything that survives that collection actually gets moved into generation one. So in fact, your generation zero heap ends up empty. The theory is that we create a lot of short-lived objects. But once an object has proved to be long-lived, that is, it's survived multiple collections, chances are it's going to live quite a while longer, so we don't want to keep checking that object. So when an allocation fails, it tries to compact, it tries to satisfy it from the generation zero, moves things onto generation one. If there's not enough room in generation one to move things in there, then it collects generation one, promotes things there to generation two, and so on. There's also a separate heap called the large object heap. I'm not going to talk about that because of lack of time. There are several ways in which GC can work. Originally, we had things called workstation GC and server GC. The idea of workstation GC was that it would minimize pauses to your process. So it would try to run in the background. It would try to do things sort of small chunks of work when it could. The idea was that in a workstation, you're dealing with interactive applications. You do not want to block the user. You don't want to have a spinny cursor while you wait for garbage to be collected. But that is less efficient because the garbage collector's got to be respectful and say, you know, okay, there's other stuff going on around me. I'm going to tread lightly. On the server, response times were not quite so urgent, and therefore server GC would do a blocking collection, which means it could just stop everything, do a collect, and move on. And it didn't have to tread lightly. It took less time overall, but it did block things. In .NET 4, they've introduced something called background GC, where each core is actually running a thread that does garbage collection kind of continually. So you get much more even performance. And there's now a new sustained low latency mode that gives you even fewer blocking long time collections. And the result of that, this is a test that one of the Microsoft engineers did. It's a little bit heuristic, but it should give you a picture of how things are working. That y-axis is showing you how long collections took. And the x-axis is showing you sort of how often a collection that long, how frequently those things occurred. So for example, around here, that's 1 in 1,000 collections took 150 milliseconds. Only 1 in 100,000 collections took as much as 200 milliseconds with these different garbage collectors. So if you've got something that's performance critical or the responsiveness is important, then tuning those GC parameters can be quite a useful technique. One thing not to do that is often very tempting is to call GC collection explicitly. And the reason for that is, okay, you may think, well, I'll just get GC collection out of the way while things are idle. The problem is that if you've got stuff that's in use at that time, it will get promoted from generation 0 to generation 1 and then up to generation 2, even though it might actually be quite short-lived. So you get a lot of stuff stuck in generation 2 and your memory footprint blows up, which is kind of counterintuitive. Okay. I've run out of time. I've got a lot more stuff to show you, but no time to show it in. I hope what I've given you is some perspective on what's going on beneath the surface of the CLR, some of the little tricks and tips and pitfalls that the CLR can give you if you don't understand what's actually happening at that level. And I hope it will help you to be more efficient and more understanding of the platform that underlies everything that we do. Thank you very much.